It was a crisp October night in 2021, and the weight of worry hung heavy on my shoulders as I watched over my parents' home in South Central Kentucky. My mother was battling pulmonary fibrosis in the county hospital, her struggle with the disease casting a shadow over our family. The knowledge that she could one day be smothered by the lack of oxygen haunted me as I patrolled the familiar grounds of our 10-acre homestead, a legacy passed down through generations. That night, my baby brother, who had already departed from this life, was my sole companion in the empty house. The rest of my family was gathered at the hospital, leaving me to keep vigil at home. As I prepared to retire to bed, a sense of unease gnawed at me, refusing to let me slip into the embrace of sleep. The air seemed charged with an indefinable tension, and every creak of the old house only amplified my discomfort. Unable to find solace in sleep, I rose from my bed and wrapped myself in a blanket against the chill of the night. Sitting at my desk, I attempted to lose myself in a book, but my mind remained tethered to the ominous feeling that lingered in the air. As I strained to concentrate on the words before me, a faint sound intruded upon the silence, a distant, haunting whistle that sent shivers down my spine. With each passing moment, the sound grew louder, echoing through the stillness of the night. Wearied by the day's labor, I hesitated to investigate, but the curiosity and unease drove me to my feet. Crossing the room, I approached the front door, the source of the eerie noise drawing me closer. Outside, the moon cast an ethereal glow upon the landscape, illuminating the tall flower stand that stood sentinel in the yard. My heart quickened as I peered through the door's window, my eyes locking onto a sight that froze me in place. A towering figure, black as midnight, looming over the flower stand. My breath caught in my throat as I watched, transfixed by the sheer enormity of the shadowy form. It stood a full head taller than the 7.5-foot flower stand, its silhouette blending seamlessly with the darkness of the night. Fear gripped me as I fumbled to unlock the door, my hands trembling as I dared to step closer. With bated breath, I watched as the figure turned and began to move, its movements fluid and deliberate as it made its way towards the dilapidated garage that stood at the edge of the property. Panic surged through me, urging me to retreat to the safety of the house, but my curiosity held me in place, rooted to the spot as I strained to catch another glimpse of the mysterious intruder. In the darkness, I could discern little of its features, only the outline of its massive frame disappearing into the shadows. My mind raced with questions, but before I could gather my wits, the figure vanished from sight, leaving me alone with the eerie stillness of the night. In the years since that chilling encounter, I have never seen the creature again, nor have I been able to shake the memory of its haunting presence. My family has since departed, leaving me to ponder the inexplicable mystery that lurked in the darkness that fateful night. If anyone has encountered a similar entity, or has information to share, I remain eager to uncover the truth behind that terrifying encounter. Ever since I was little, the woods of North Alabama have been my second home. Dad always said nature was the best teacher, and I was his eager student, following him into the dense forests with a mix of reverence and excitement. I learned to tread lightly on the forest floor, to listen to the whispers of the wind through the trees, and to find my place in the wild. It wasn't just a hobby, it was our bond, a sacred connection between father and daughter. My whole life I've felt at ease in the wilderness, except when the sun dips below the horizon. Night transforms the familiar into the unknown, and every shadow seems to hide a secret. Despite my comfort during the day, the darkness brings a paranoia I can't shake. I've never let it stop me, though. I always have my trusty flashlight, and more importantly, my dad's old hunting rifle by my side. "Always be prepared," Dad would say, and I took his words to heart. My birthday was no exception to this rule. I expected a quiet celebration at home, maybe a small cake and a few presents. But my boyfriend Mark had other plans. He told me to pack for an overnight trip, a surprise he'd been planning for weeks. As we drove, I recognized the road leading to our favorite secluded riverbank, a place teeming with memories of lazy afternoons spent hammocking and fishing trips with Dad. The excitement bubbled inside me, tempered only by the sinking sun and the creeping shadows of the evening. By the time we arrived, darkness had already claimed the sky, a velvet backdrop pierced by the silver light of the stars. Mark parked the truck so the tailgate faced the river, the hood nestled against the tree line. The air was filled with the sweet scent of pine and the soft murmur of the water. I tried to push aside the unease that gnawed at me, focusing instead on the moment and the effort Mark had put into this surprise. He really went all out. The bed of the truck was transformed into our own little oasis, complete with an air mattress, my favorite candy, soda, cheesecake, and even a slice of birthday cake. Mark had thought of everything. We spent the next half hour wrapped up in our own world, talking, laughing, and sharing dreams under the canopy of stars. Our peaceful interlude was briefly interrupted by a police officer. He seemed more amused than concerned by our unconventional setup. After a quick chat, he left us with a warning to be careful, mentioning vaguely that some crazy crap's been going on lately. It was a jarring reminder of the unpredictability of our chosen haven, but we brushed it off, too caught up in the magic of the night. As we lay back, gazing up at the stars, I felt a sense of peace settle over me. Here, with Mark, I felt safe. His presence was a comforting constant, an anchor in the ever-changing world. For a while, I forgot about the darkness, the warnings, and the unease. It was just us, the stars, and the gentle lull of the river. But that tranquility was about to be shattered in a way that would remind me why my instincts were never to be ignored. The night was deepening, wrapping us in a blanket of darkness that seemed to mute the world around us. Mark and I lay there on the makeshift bed in the back of his truck, surrounded by the quiet sounds of nature and the soft glow of our lantern. For a moment, I let myself forget the unease that always accompanied me in the woods after dark. With Mark by my side, the familiar fears seemed distant, almost inconsequential. That was until the unexpected happened. It started with the arrival of a police officer, a brief interruption that was more amusing than alarming at the time. His casual warning about some crazy crap going on in the area should have raised red flags, but we laughed it off, too wrapped up in our own little bubble to take it seriously. Looking back, I wish we had paid more attention. The tranquility of the evening shattered with a sound that seemed out of place, even in the wilderness. A snap of twigs from the tree line, too deliberate, too close. My heart skipped a beat, and I could feel Mark tense up beside me. We exchanged a look, a silent agreement to stay still and listen, hoping it was just a deer or some harmless creature passing by. But the woods remained eerily silent after that initial noise, as if the forest itself was holding its breath. Then another sound, a rustling, closer this time, and unmistakably intentional. Every story my dad had told me about the woods at night came flooding back, each tale of caution and respect for the wild. My hand instinctively moved to the small knife I always carried, a feeble reassurance against the unknown. Mark and I lay there in silence. The music we had been playing seemed miles away now, irrelevant in the face of our growing apprehension. The rustling continued, a soft but unmistakable sound of movement in the underbrush. It was clear now that we weren't alone, and the visitor wasn't just passing through. The tension was palpable, a thick cloud that settled over us. I remembered my father's lessons, how to remain calm, how to think clearly even when fear threatened to take over. But knowing what to do and actually doing it are two very different things. In that moment, I felt more vulnerable than I ever had in these woods. Time seemed to stretch, each second a lifetime, as we waited for whatever was out there to reveal itself. But it didn't. Instead, the sound slowly receded, moving away from us and toward the parking lot. Relief washed over me in waves, but it was short-lived. The quiet that followed was almost worse, a suffocating silence that left too much to the imagination. I whispered to Mark, my voice barely audible. "What do you think it was?" He didn't answer, his eyes fixed on the darkness beyond our little circle of light. The reassurance I sought never came. Instead, a new sound broke the silence. The unmistakable cry of a goose in distress from the direction of the river. Fear gripped me then, a visceral primal fear. It wasn't just the darkness or the unknown anymore. It was the realization that we were not at the top of the food chain here. Whatever was out there, it was bold, unafraid, and very much interested in us. Mark's calm voice broke through my panic. We should pack up. But even as he spoke, I knew leaving wouldn't be simple. The forest had come alive in the worst possible way, and the night was far from over. After the unsettling interruption by the goose's distress calls, Mark and I knew we couldn't just ignore what was happening around us. The night that was meant to be a celebration of my birthday had turned into a sequence of eerie events that neither of us could have anticipated. As much as I wanted to cling to the safety of ignorance, the reality was impossible to ignore. The woods felt different now, hostile and alive with an unseen threat. Mark suggested we start packing up, his voice steady but underlined with urgency. I nodded, trying to swallow the lump of fear in my throat. The simple act of folding blankets and gathering our belongings felt like a monumental task, every rustle of the fabric seeming to echo through the silent woods. My hands trembled as I worked, casting nervous glances toward the tree line that had transformed from a familiar backdrop into a menacing wall of shadows. The sounds of the goose being attacked had ceased, leaving a heavy silence in their wake. It was this silence that unnerved me the most, a stark reminder that something was out there, something bold enough to hunt so close to humans. Mark tried to reassure me with a smile, but it didn't reach his eyes. We both knew we were not safe. With everything packed except for the air mattress, Mark began deflating it, his movements quick and efficient. I stood by the truck, my senses on high alert, jumping at every slight noise. The air was thick with tension, the kind that made it hard to breathe, hard to think. I wanted to scream, to run, but I stood frozen, caught in the grip of an instinctive fear. Then, it happened. A goose call, frantic and close. My heart raced, and Mark paused, looking toward the riverbank. "That goose is being attacked. Get in the truck," he said, his tone leaving no room for argument. I didn't need to be told twice. I scrambled into the truck, slamming the door shut behind me. From the safety of the vehicle, we listened as the calls grew more desperate, then suddenly stopped. Silence fell again, heavy and ominous. Sitting in the truck, the reality of our situation sank in. Whatever had attacked the goose was bold, unafraid, and close. Too close. Mark's calm demeanor was a thin veil over the concern etched deep in his face. We were in danger, a kind of danger neither of us had encountered before. Not from a coyote, not a bobcat, but something else, something unknown and terrifying. After a tense wait, Mark said he'd finish packing. I watched him through the truck's back window, my anxiety spiking with each passing second. He worked quickly, but every movement seemed to last an eternity. Then, from the direction of the riverbank, came a sound that chilled me to the bone. A low, guttural huffing, the sound of a predator. Panic surged through me. "Mark, get back here!" I shouted, barely recognizing my own voice, thick with fear. He hesitated, then, to my horror, moved toward the sound with the flashlight. "No! What are you doing?" I thought, my mind racing with images of what might happen. Mark's exploration was brief, but it felt like hours before he returned to the safety of the truck. "I saw it," he said, his voice eerily calm. "Dark, low to the ground, big." Those words confirmed my worst fears. We weren't dealing with any ordinary animal. As Mark drove us away from that place, the woods seemed to watch, silent and unyielding. Whatever lurked in the shadows remained a mystery, a shadowy figure in a night filled with fear. That night changed everything. It was a harsh reminder that the wild is untamed, unpredictable, and sometimes terrifyingly close. As Mark turned the truck onto the main road, leaving the riverbank and its nightmares behind, The adrenaline that had fueled my fear began to ebb away, leaving me trembling and exhausted. The comforting hum of the engine and the passing streetlights did little to dispel the image of that dark, low-to-the-ground creature Mark had described. My mind raced with possibilities, none of them comforting. What had we encountered back there? And more importantly, why had it felt so malevolent? The drive home was silent, each of us lost in our thoughts. Mark kept his eyes on the road, his jaw set in a way that told me he was just as shaken as I was, despite his calm exterior. I wanted to ask him more about what he saw, to try and make sense of it, but the words wouldn't come. Instead, I leaned against the window, watching the darkness of the woods blur by, feeling an overwhelming sense of relief to be leaving it behind. Once we were safely inside my house, the tension that had gripped me began to dissipate. The familiar surroundings, the soft glow of the lamps, and the quiet made the evening's events feel almost surreal. Mark and I sat down on the couch, finally allowing ourselves to relax, to really talk about what had happened. "It was probably just a bear or something," Mark tried to reassure me, though we both knew that wasn't true. Bears didn't move like that, didn't silence the woods around them with their presence. "I don't know what it was," he finally admitted, "but I've never seen anything like it before." I nodded, feeling a chill run down my spine at the memory of the sounds, the fear, and the unknown. It was a stark reminder of the respect nature demands, of the fine line between feeling at home in the wilderness and realizing you're an intruder in a world not your own. That night, as I lay in bed trying to find sleep, my thoughts kept returning to the woods, to the creature, and to the primal fear it had awakened in me. I thought about my dad and the countless lessons he had taught me about respecting the wild, about always being aware of my surroundings. I realized that this experience was, in its own terrifying way, another lesson. It was a reminder that no matter how comfortable or familiar you might feel in nature, there's always something more to learn, always something unexpected lurking just beyond the light of your campfire. In the days that followed, the encounter at the riverbank became a story Mark and I shared cautiously, not sure how it would be received or even fully believed. But for me, it was more than just a story. It was a defining moment. It was the night I truly understood the depth of my dad's teachings, the importance of listening to my instincts, and the reality that the wilderness is a beautiful but untamed force. I don't know if I'll ever go back to that riverbank. The memories of that night are too raw, the shadows too filled with unanswered questions, but I do know that I'll carry the lessons learned with me, always respecting the wild, always aware of the thin veil that separates the known from the unknown. That night, under a canopy of stars turned witness to fear, I grew up a little more, understanding that the world is vast, mysterious, and always demanding respect. The early morning light filtered through the curtains, casting a warm glow over the kitchen where I stood, mixing batter for pancakes. It was a ritual, one of many that had defined my life over the past 35 years. I was a wife, a mother, and so much more. I believed in the vows I took with Luther, in sickness and in health, for richer or poorer. Those weren't just words to me, they were the foundation of our life together. Luther was still asleep, the quiet hum of his breath a comforting reminder of the life we shared. Our home was silent, save for the occasional creak of the old wooden floors, a testament to the years we spent under this roof. It was a good life, filled with love, laughter, and the inevitable struggles that came our way, but we faced them together, always. I remembered when Luther lost his job during my third pregnancy. The news had hit us like a winter storm, cold and unrelenting, but we were a team, and failure wasn't an option. With two toddlers already demanding our attention and a third on the way, I took on temporary jobs, juggling motherhood and the need to provide for our family. It was a testament to my determination, to the promise I made to stand by Luther in every conceivable situation. Our friends often remarked on how well we complemented each other. I was the anchor, the calm in the storm, while Luther was the dreamer, always looking for the next opportunity. They didn't see the sacrifices, the sleepless nights, and the endless days of hard work that went into making our life appear effortless. But I didn't mind. I took pride in our home, in the well-being of our children, and in the support I provided Luther, even when it meant setting aside my own dreams. The scent of pancakes began to fill the kitchen, a familiar and comforting aroma. It was more than just breakfast. It was a symbol of the life I had built, of the unwavering support and love I had given my family. As the perfect wife, I thought I knew what it meant to struggle, to fight for what was important. But I was about to learn that some battles are fought alone, and some vows are easier made than kept. Looking back, I realized that my definition of marriage was rooted in the past, in a time when roles were clearly defined and challenges were met together. But life has a way of testing us, of revealing truths we're not prepared to face. In the years to come, my belief in those sacred vows would be shattered, leaving me to question everything I thought I knew about love, commitment, and the true meaning of in sickness and in health. As I poured the batter into the skillet, I couldn't help but feel a sense of pride in the life we had built. It was a beautiful, intricate tapestry of shared experiences, woven together by love and unwavering dedication. But as the pancakes cooked, turning golden brown, I was blissfully unaware of the storm that was brewing on the horizon, a storm that would test the very fabric of our marriage and force me to confront the reality of what it means to stand alone. The day was overcast, a blanket of gray clouds casting shadows over the rugged landscape that had been the backdrop of our lives. It was on one of these dreary days that our world tilted, the axis upon which we spun irrevocably shifted by two words: breast cancer. The diagnosis came like a bullet, swift and unexpected. It pierced the veil of normalcy we had draped over our lives, revealing a vulnerability I had never felt. Luther was beside me, his presence a silent testament to the vows we had taken. Yet, as the doctor spoke, outlining treatment options with clinical detachment, I saw a change in him. It was subtle at first, a stiffening of his shoulders, a distant look in his eyes that I had never seen before. I tried to convince myself it was fear, a natural reaction to the possibility of losing the one you love. But deep down, a seed of doubt took root, watered by his growing detachment. In the days that followed, Luther's absence became more pronounced. He missed appointments, retreating into a shell of avoidance I couldn't penetrate. I had imagined us facing this challenge together, a united front against the disease that threatened to tear apart our world. Instead, I found myself increasingly isolated, clinging to the hope that his support would manifest when I needed it most. It never did. The realization that I was alone in this fight was a bitter pill to swallow. I had been the cornerstone of our family, the one who held everything together when the world outside threatened to intrude. Now, when I needed that strength returned, it was nowhere to be found. The internet became my companion during those long, sleepless nights. It was during one of these solitary vigils that I stumbled upon a truth I hadn't been prepared to face. Forums filled with stories of women abandoned by their husbands, following a cancer diagnosis, painted a stark picture of my potential future. The thought that Luther could be among those who walked away was inconceivable, yet the evidence was mounting with each missed appointment, each avoided conversation. The day Luther left, it was with a note that spoke of his inability to face the reality of my illness. "I didn't sign up for this," it read, a simple sentence that unraveled the fabric of our 35-year marriage. In that moment, the vows we had taken, in sickness and in health, seemed like nothing more than empty words, a promise made but not meant to be kept. As I navigated the labyrinth of treatment options alone, the chasm between us grew wider. The side effects of chemotherapy were a constant reminder of the battle I was fighting, a battle made all the more difficult by Luther's absence. The man who had been my partner, my support, had become a stranger, leaving me to wonder if he had ever truly understood the meaning of the vows we took. In the wake of his departure, I was forced to confront a new reality, one where I faced not only cancer, but the dissolution of my marriage. It was a test of my strength, my resilience, and my ability to stand alone against the storm. And as I looked out at the gray sky, I knew that no matter what lay ahead, I would face it with the same determination that had defined my life. Because in the end, the only vow that mattered was the one I made to myself: to survive, to fight, and to emerge from this battle stronger than before. The cold reality of Luther's betrayal was like the harsh Wyoming wind, relentless and biting. The life we had built, the home that was supposed to be our sanctuary, now felt like a house of cards, teetering on the brink of collapse. I stood alone in the silence of our living room, surrounded by memories that seemed to mock me with their permanence, a stark contrast to the impermanence of love and loyalty I'd once believed unshakable. The financial deceit cut deeper than the emotional abandonment. Discovering that everything, from the house to our savings, was in Luther's name, was a blow that knocked the breath from me. It was a calculated move, one that left me vulnerable and exposed. The foundation I had worked so hard to build for our family was built on sand, and Luther had just let the tide come in. I had always taken pride in my independence, my ability to stand tall in the face of adversity. But this was a different kind of battle. It was one that required more than just resilience. It demanded a strategy. As I sifted through the detritus of our marriage, I uncovered evidence of Luther's infidelity. Old hotel receipts, gifts meant for someone else, tokens of a betrayal that extended beyond the abandonment. Each discovery was a piece of the puzzle, a narrative of neglect that had been years in the making. The legal battles that ensued were like navigating a minefield, each step fraught with danger and uncertainty. But I was not without my allies. Wendy, my sister-in-law, emerged as an unexpected beacon of hope. Her support, unwavering and sincere, was a lifeline in the tumultuous sea of divorce proceedings and chemo treatments. She was there, a constant presence, reminding me that not all was lost. Together, we devised a plan. It wasn't enough to simply win the legal battle. We needed to ensure that justice was served, that Luther's actions did not go unpunished. My appearance in court was calculated, a portrayal of vulnerability that belied the inner strength that had carried me through the darkest days. I wanted Luther to see the consequences of his actions, to witness the pain and suffering his betrayal had caused. The courtroom became our battleground, and with each appearance, I could feel the tide turning in our favor. Luther's demands were denied one by one, the judge swayed by the evidence of his deceit and the testimony of a wife who had given everything to her marriage, only to be repaid with treachery. In the end, the victory was bittersweet. The house and a portion of our savings were mine, but the cost was immeasurable. The man I had loved, the partner I had trusted, had become a stranger, his actions a stark reminder of the fragility of human relationships. As I stood in the empty house, now solely mine, I realized that the battle had changed me. I was no longer the woman who believed in the sanctity of marriage vows, in the promise of in sickness and in health. I had emerged from the fallout stronger, wiser, and with a newfound understanding of my own resilience. The road ahead was uncertain, but for the first time in a long time, I felt ready to face whatever came my way. The dust had settled on the legal battleground, leaving a landscape reshaped by the scars of war. The house, once a symbol of our shared life, now stood as a monument to my victory, a victory that tasted more of ashes than of triumph. The possessions we had gathered over the years were divided, each item a testament to a love that had withered in the harsh light of betrayal. I had won, but at what cost? The man I had spent over 3 decades with had become my adversary, a stranger fueled by selfishness and cowardice. Yet, as I looked around at the walls that had witnessed the best and worst of our lives together, I realized that this was not the end. It was a beginning. The chapter of my life that included Luther was closed, sealed with the bitterness of betrayal and the sweet satisfaction of justice served. But beyond that chapter lay uncharted territory, a future I had never envisioned but was now eager to explore. My health was improving, the cancer retreating before the onslaught of treatment and determination. The physical scars would heal, but the emotional wounds would take longer. It was in this period of transition that I found true redemption. Wendy, ever the ally, had not only stood by me through the storm, but had also inadvertently brought my family back into my orbit. The day Luther had attempted to confront me, only to be met by the collective strength of my children, was the day I realized I was not alone. Their anger at being kept in the dark was overshadowed by their love and concern for me, a bond that Luther's actions could not sever. Moving in with Anna, my daughter, was a step towards healing. It was a chance to rebuild the relationships that had been strained by distance and silence, a silence born out of a misguided attempt to shield them from pain. In their company, I found a joy and a peace that had eluded me for years. They were my redemption, my second chance at a life filled with love and laughter. As I settled into this new phase of my life, I couldn't help but reflect on the lessons learned from the ordeal. The vows of marriage, once sacred, now held a different meaning for me. In sickness and in health, was not just a promise to be made by two people standing at an altar. It was a commitment that required strength, sacrifice, and an unwavering dedication to one another, a commitment that Luther had failed to uphold. I no longer viewed marriage through rose-colored glasses, nor did I judge those who chose to walk a different path. Life was too short, too unpredictable to be bound by the expectations of others. It was a truth that had been hard won, a truth that would guide me as I navigated the years ahead. Redemption had come not in the form of legal victories, or the satisfaction of seeing Luther brought low. It came through the love of my family, the support of friends like Wendy, and the realization that strength lay in the ability to move forward, to embrace the unknown with open arms and a heart ready to love again. My story was not one of defeat, but of resilience, a testament to the power of the human spirit to overcome even the darkest of times. I remember the day I moved to Florida vividly, a couple of years ago. It was a new beginning, a fresh start in a place where I never once imagined something sinister could dwell. Little did I know, the tranquility of my new surroundings would soon be shattered by an unearthly terror that lurked nearby. Our family didn't own a farm, but our property was teeming with animals, chickens, geese, cats, and dogs, just to name a few. The cats and dogs were typically kept indoors, shielded from whatever malevolent force roamed outside. But our feathered friends weren't so lucky. They became frequent victims, often mutilated beyond recognition. Feathers strewn about, with only remnants of wings or feet left behind. At first, I rationalized these gruesome scenes as the work of raccoons or bobcats. However, as the attacks escalated and our robust pilgrim geese began to vanish without a trace, I knew it was something far more sinister. Pilgrim geese aren't easily subdued. Their loud protests would have echoed through the night if they were merely attacked by common predators. Yet, the eerie silence that followed their disappearances spoke volumes. I sought answers from my neighbors, hoping for some rational explanation, but all I received were cryptic warnings to stay out of the woods at night. Ignoring their advice, I ventured into those woods with a mixture of curiosity and dread, only to find myself face to face with a horror beyond comprehension. Fast forward a couple of years, and the presence of this malevolent entity had become an unsettling norm in my life. My parents' frequent trips out of town left me alone, a situation I didn't mind. I wasn't one for wild parties, and my parents trusted me implicitly, but it was during one of these solitary stretches that I made a grave mistake. Disregarding the cardinal rule of not inviting people over, I indulged in a night of casual revelry with my girlfriend and a few friends. The first two nights passed without incident, but it was on the third night that things took a sinister turn. It was just me and my girlfriend, Alice, lazily lounging around the house when she suggested a midnight stroll through the woods. Despite the late hour, I agreed, lulled into a false sense of security by the familiarity of our surroundings. As we wandered deeper into the woods, I couldn't shake the feeling of unease gnawing at my gut. But Alice seemed undeterred, her laughter ringing out in the darkness as we ventured further from the safety of home. We stumbled upon a clearing, and Alice, ever the carefree spirit, skipped to its center, her laughter echoing in the night. But as she beckoned me forward, I hesitated, a sense of foreboding washing over me. I reluctantly joined her, capturing the moment on a disposable camera before pulling her into a tight embrace. In that fleeting moment of bliss, the illusion of safety shattered, as a voice, mirroring Alice's own, whispered, "I love you." Panic surged through me as I turned towards the source of the voice, only to be confronted by a grotesque abomination. A deer-like creature stood before us, its form twisted and contorted in ways that defied nature. Its grin stretched impossibly wide, revealing rows of razor-sharp teeth dripping with saliva. Terror rooted me to the spot as the creature advanced, its distorted voice echoing Alice's endearments. With a primal instinct for survival, I fled, dragging Alice along in my wake. But my flight was short-lived as I stumbled, crashing to the forest floor. The creature seized me, its chilling declaration of love ringing in my ears as it loomed over me. In a desperate bid for escape, I lashed out, striking it with a nearby rock before bolting into the night. We fled through the woods, pursued by the creature's unearthly cries, until we burst back into the safety of my home, bolting the doors behind us. Exhausted and shaken, we huddled together, clinging to each other as the night dragged on, haunted by the creature's relentless pursuit. As dawn broke, we parted ways, seeking refuge in the familiarity of Alice's home. But even there, the specter of that night lingered, a reminder of the horrors lurking just beyond the safety of our walls. In the days that followed, we dared not speak of our ordeal, haunted by the memory of that twisted creature and the knowledge that it still roamed the woods outside. And though life eventually returned to normalcy, the shadows of that fateful night lingered, a reminder that some terrors are too great to be forgotten. I'm just a 19-year-old guy, and this story takes place on a national battlefield, specifically Prairie Grove Park in northern Arkansas, nestled within the rugged Ozark Mountains. It was early December, and hundreds of us gathered for a reenactment of the historic Battle of Prairie Grove. My friends and I, all around the same age, were there to immerse ourselves in the experience, whether it was attending dances, indulging in drinks, or simply wandering around during scheduled breaks. These weekends were always packed with camaraderie and excitement. Friday arrived like any other, with everyone converging on the site. After donning our period costumes, we formed into our respective battalions and marched off to set up camp. Nothing particularly noteworthy happened on Friday night. Most of us were exhausted from the long drives and retired to our tents to rest, seeking solace from the biting chill of winter winds. Saturday dawned, and the day unfolded much like the previous ones. We participated in battles for the delight of spectators, lounged around camp, and generally enjoyed ourselves. However, as night descended upon the battlefield, the atmosphere took a chilling turn. Following our mock skirmishes, my battalion was tasked with picket duty, guarding our encampment against potential threats. It was around 1 a.m. when my company was called to take our turn. Picket duty typically lasted about an hour and a half, and my partner and I were stationed at the farthest end of our line, with our left flank ominously exposed. Approximately 30 minutes into our vigil, we heard the unmistakable sound of footsteps to our left. Alert and vigilant, we readied our rifles, scanning the darkness for any signs of enemy pickets. After around 15 tense minutes passed without incident, we allowed ourselves a moment of respite. I lit my pipe, attempting to relax, when suddenly, piercing screams shattered the tranquility of the night. Startled, we sprang to attention, only to witness a shadowy figure darting through the tall grass before us. Moonlight cast an eerie glow upon its canine-like form. Frantically, we called out to nearby pickets, urging them to fall back to our officer. Before I could make a move, a large rock hurtled towards me from behind, striking me squarely in the back and knocking the wind from my lungs. Collapsed on the ground, I struggled to regain my breath, my eyes fixated on the source of the attack. My heart froze in terror as a towering, 7-foot-tall creature emerged from the darkness. Its ghastly appearance defied description. A pallid, grotesque visage with eyes as black as the abyss, a sinister grin stretching impossibly wide across its face. Paralyzed with fear, I watched as it advanced towards me, its elongated arms dripping with what looked like blood. Summoning every ounce of courage I possessed, I reached for my rifle, preparing to defend myself with trembling hands. As I staggered to my feet, the creature lurched forward, sending me fleeing into the night. Every thunderous footfall behind me served as a grim reminder of the imminent danger. I could feel its hot breath on the nape of my neck, propelling me forward in a frenzied sprint. Exhausted and terrified, I finally stumbled back to my company, my body trembling uncontrollably from the adrenaline-fueled ordeal. To my dismay, my comrades seemed oblivious to the horrors that had unfolded in the darkness. Desperate and shaken, I recounted the harrowing encounter, but their disbelief only deepened my sense of dread. With dawn's arrival, I mustered the courage to return to the scene, accompanied by a few brave souls. There, amidst the tall grass, we discovered the lifeless remains of a deer, its body marred by 3 deep gashes, eerie echoes of the wounds I had sustained. Shaken to my core, I resolved to leave the battlefield behind, haunted by the specter of that dreadful night. The journey home was a silent one, my mind consumed by thoughts of the monstrous entity that had stalked me in the darkness. In the ensuing months, sleep eluded me, my grades suffering as a result of the relentless exhaustion. Eventually, I made the decision to distance myself from reenactments, granting myself a much-needed respite from the terrors that had besieged me. Yet, even now, the memory of that malevolent presence lingers, a stark reminder of the unfathomable horrors that lurk within the shadows. I know, with unwavering certainty, that I will never return to Prairie Grove, lest that insidious creature unleash its wrath once more, its mercy exhausted, and its hunger for fear left unsated. Part 1. The Dawn in Hera was a silent witness to the ordinary beginnings of what would soon become an extraordinary day. The sky, a canvas of soft blues and pinks, promised nothing more than the usual tranquility of a small town, waking up to its routine. It was on this unassuming backdrop that Jose Cantu, a boy of 9 years, stumbled upon a truth so bewildering it would unsettle the very foundations of his world. Jose's day started like any other. The shrill cry of his alarm clock pierced the calm of his room at 6:30 in the morning, a signal to shed the remnants of sleep and embrace the day ahead. With the practiced ease of a school week's routine, he rolled out of bed, his thoughts already on the tasks that lay before him. Yet nothing in his 9 years of life could have prepared him for what was waiting just beyond the pane of his kitchen window. The Cantu household was a modest one, nestled on the edge of Hera, where the hum of the town softened into whispers. Jose's mother, a woman of resilience worn by the countless challenges of raising a family on her own, was still asleep. Her rest deserved yet fleeting, with an infant in the house. It was in this quiet, in the simple act of preparing his breakfast, that Jose's world shifted. Movement outside the window, so subtle yet unmistakably out of place, caught his eye. There, in the dim light of dawn, were figures moving with an eerie deliberation in his backyard. Small, they were, smaller than any person Jose had ever seen. His heart raced, a mix of fear and curiosity propelling him towards the unknown. With a haste born of youthful impulsiveness, Jose dashed upstairs to rouse his mother. "Mom," he exclaimed, his voice tinged with the urgency of his discovery. But his words fell on the exhausted ears of a woman who had spent the night in the tender battleground of parenthood, soothing an infant's cries. Her dismissal was swift, a reflexive response to what she perceived as her son's overactive imagination. Undeterred and driven by a resolve that was rare for his age, Jose decided to confront the mystery himself. The backyard, a familiar place transformed by the strange presence, now seemed alien. As he stepped outside, the cool morning air did little to calm his racing heart. The figures, bizarre in their appearance and intent, paid him no heed, their focus elsewhere. The urge to flee, to hide from the inexplicable, overtook him. An old broken washing machine near the shed offered a semblance of refuge. From this vantage point he watched, his fear mingling with fascination. The figures, their features obscured by the distance and his hiding spot, were unlike anything he had ever seen or heard of. When the figures vanished as mysteriously as they had appeared, Jose's initial terror gave way to a burning need to share his experience. His mother, still skeptical, found her patience worn thin by his insistent tales of the strange visitors. It wasn't until the light of day revealed the undeniable marks left behind in the yard that the seeds of belief began to take root, not just in his mother, but in the wider community of Hera. As word spread, Jose Cantu found himself at the center of a whirlwind of attention. His ordinary morning transformed into the catalyst for an extraordinary journey into the unknown. The town of Hera, with its quiet streets and unassuming ways, was now touched by a mystery that defied explanation, setting the stage for a tale that would echo far beyond its borders. Part 2. In the span of history, there are moments that bleed through the fabric of time, leaving their mark across generations. So it was with the phenomena that found its way into the lives of those separated by decades and continents, stitching together a narrative as complex as it was unsettling. Sweden, 1963. The land was a tableau of serenity, nature's brush painting scenes of tranquility that belied the stirring of ancient forces. Carl Gustav Carlson, a man of the earth, was no stranger to the rhythms of nature. His garden, nestled behind the modest cottage he called home, was his sanctuary. Yet, on a day that began like any other, his sanctuary became the stage for an encounter that would challenge the very essence of his understanding. The beings that appeared in his garden were as out of place as a snowstorm in summer. Their grotesque forms, barely resembling the human figure, moved with a purpose that was inscrutable. Carlson, rooted to the spot, felt a primal fear gnaw at his resolve. These were not creatures of this world, nor of his imagination. They were real as the fear that tightened its grip around his heart. Decades later, across the ocean, a similar tale unfolded under a different sky. Ethan, a young boy still grappling with the loss of his grandfather, found his world invaded by a presence that defied explanation. The sleepover, a child's attempt to find solace in companionship, became the backdrop for an encounter with an entity that bore the unmistakable mark of the cycloptic phenomena. Its formidable form, a stark contrast to the vulnerability of youth, left an imprint on Ethan's psyche that time could not erode. These stories, separated by years and miles, were woven from the same thread. The entities that Carlson and Ethan encountered were not bound by the constraints of time or geography. They were harbingers of a truth that lurked in the shadows of understanding, manifestations of a reality that danced on the edge of human comprehension. The cycloptic enigma, as it came to be known, was not merely a series of isolated incidents. It was a pattern, a recurring motif in the tapestry of human experience. From the ancient myths of Cyclopes to the modern-day encounters with beings of unfathomable origin, the single-eyed visage emerged as a symbol of the unknown, a challenge to the boundaries of belief. In Hera, as in Sweden and countless other places touched by this phenomenon, the stories of those who witnessed the cycloptic beings became a testament to the enduring mystery of existence. They were tales of fear and fascination, of the collision between the known world and the realms that lie just beyond perception. As the narrative of the cycloptic enigma unfolded, it beckoned to those who dared to listen, offering a glimpse into the abyss of the unknown. It was a call that transcended time and space, a whisper from the void that asked the timeless question, what lies beyond the veil of human understanding? Part 3. In the heart of mythology, nestled among tales of gods and monsters, the legend of the Cyclops has persisted through the ages. These one-eyed giants, formidable and fearsome, were said to dwell in the distant corners of the ancient world, a symbol of the mysteries that lay beyond the ken of mortal men. But in the small town of Hera, as well as in distant lands across the globe, the myth seemed to awaken, stepping forth from the pages of history into the reality of the present. The connection between these ancient legends and the modern sightings of cycloptic beings posed a question that tantalized the curious and the brave. Was there a thread that linked the past to the present? A lineage of truth that stretched back to the dawn of civilization? Or were these encounters merely the projections of collective human consciousness, a manifestation of our primal fears and fascinations? In Hera, the cycloptic phenomenon had become more than a curiosity. It was a challenge to the community's understanding of the world. Jose Cantu's encounter, and the subsequent sightings that echoed it, drew a line that connected the town to the ancient past. It was as if the Cyclops of legend had walked out of the mists of time, demanding to be acknowledged in a world that had relegated them to the realm of fairy tales. Theories abounded, some rooted in science, others in speculation. The discovery of ancient elephant skulls by paleontologists offered a rational explanation for the origin of the Cyclops myth. The large central cavity, mistaken for a single eye socket, provided a plausible basis for the tales of ancient monsters. Yet this explanation did not account for the living, breathing encounters that continued to surface in the modern world. As the community grappled with these revelations, the cycloptic enigma invited a deeper exploration of the boundary between myth and reality. It was a journey that ventured into the shadowy realms of the unknown, where the mysteries of the past intertwined with the mysteries of the present. The Cyclops, once a symbol of ancient fears, had become a beacon that illuminated the vast expanse of human ignorance. It was a reminder that the world was still full of wonders and horrors that defied explanation, that the universe was larger and more complex than the human mind could fully comprehend. In this chapter of the story, the cycloptic enigma served as a bridge between the world of the ancients and the world of today. It challenged the characters to look beyond the surface of their beliefs, to question the narratives that had shaped their understanding of the universe. The legend of the Cyclops, reborn in the modern encounters, was a testament to the enduring power of myth. It was a story that transcended time, a story that connected the people of Hera to their ancestors and to the generations yet to come. In the face of the cycloptic phenomenon, the past and the present merged, weaving a tale of mystery and discovery that promised to unravel the very fabric of reality. Part 4. In the mosaic of human experience, there are pieces that refuse to fit, that defy the orderly patterns we strive to impose. Such was the nature of the encounters that spanned continents, each a fragment of the cycloptic enigma that refused to be ignored or explained away. In the vibrant heart of Brazil, beneath the dense canopy of the suburbs of Belo Horizonte, the ordinary flow of life was interrupted by an encounter that stretched the limits of belief. A group of residents, bound by the mundane rhythms of suburban life, became unwitting witnesses to an event that would etch itself into the fabric of their collective memory. A creature, its skin a startling red, emerged from the shadows, a living anomaly that bore the unmistakable mark of the cycloptic myth. The being's appearance, so at odds with the natural order, sent ripples of fear through the witnesses. Its single eye, a portal to an unknown world, challenged the very notion of reality. The encounter, brief yet profound, left behind a trail of questions that wound through the community like a river seeking the sea. It was an episode that echoed the ancient tales of Cyclopes, yet it unfolded in the heart of modern Brazil, a bridge between worlds that should not have intersected. Half a world away, in the orderly grid of Minneapolis streets, another thread of the cycloptic tapestry revealed itself. A man, caught in the mundane act of waiting for a train, found himself face to face with an impossibility. The driver of a green minivan, clad in a trench coat, bore the hallmarks of the cycloptic beings that had haunted the edges of human consciousness for millennia. This creature, its appearance so incongruous with its suburban surroundings, seemed to struggle with its own form, a detail that hinted at a reality too complex for simple explanations. These encounters, disparate yet linked by the singular feature of the cycloptic eye, served as a reminder that the world is filled with mysteries that elude our grasp. The beings that appeared in Brazil and Minneapolis were not mere anomalies. They were emissaries from the unknown, challenging the inhabitants of Hera and beyond to question the nature of their reality. As the cycloptic enigma unfolded, it wove a complex narrative that spanned the spectrum of human experience. From the ancient myths that lingered in the collective memory to the modern encounters that defied explanation, the cycloptic being stood at the intersection of the known and the unknown. In Hera, as in Belo Horizonte and Minneapolis, the stories of these encounters became a catalyst for exploration and introspection. They prompted a reevaluation of the limits of human understanding, inviting a deeper inquiry into the mysteries that lie beyond the veil of the visible world. Chapter 4 of the saga was not merely a collection of encounters, it was a journey into the heart of the unknown. It challenged the characters, and through them, the readers, to embrace the uncertainty that lies at the core of the human experience. In the face of the cycloptic enigma, the world was revealed to be a place of endless wonder and impenetrable mystery, a canvas on which the ancient and the modern danced in the shadows of the unexplained. Part 5. In the vast tapestry of existence, where the threads of the personal and the universal intertwine, lies the true essence of the cycloptic enigma. It was in the intimate confines of a Texas home and the shadowed woods behind Randall's house that this essence was laid bare, revealing the depth of the mystery that bound the individuals to the collective fate of humanity's quest for understanding. In Fort Hood, Texas, a man found himself at the edge of reality, where the comfort of his bed became the stage for an encounter that blurred the lines between dream and awakening. The presence that visited him in the dead of night, with its single, unblinking eye, was a harbinger of truths too vast and too ancient for the human mind to fully grasp. This entity, devoid of recognizable features yet unmistakably sentient, whispered words that echoed through the corridors of the man's psyche, leaving behind a tangible mark of its visitation. The encounter, while deeply personal, rippled outward, touching the lives of those who heard the tale. It was a reminder that the cycloptic beings, though elusive, left behind evidence of their presence, evidence that challenged the skeptical and emboldened the believers. The scratch that marked the man's face was more than a physical wound. It was a signpost pointing toward the intersection of the known and the unknown, where the personal experiences of individuals became part of a larger, more universal story. In the woods behind Randall's house, the mystery took on a different form. The figure that appeared to the group of boys, clad in a copper mask with a singular eye, was a manifestation of the cycloptic enigma that straddled the boundary between folklore and reality. This being, its motives as inscrutable as its origins, vanished behind a tree, leaving behind a trail of questions that wound through the woods like the roots of ancient trees. The boys' encounter, while frightening, was a catalyst for a series of strange occurrences that Randall would experience in the woods. These events, from the unhuman hooting that surrounded him to the palpable sense of being hunted, were threads in the intricate web of the cycloptic enigma. They served as a testament to the fact that the mystery was not confined to isolated incidents, but was woven into the very fabric of the natural world. As the saga of the cycloptic enigma unfolded, it became clear that the line between the personal and the universal was as fluid as the boundary between myth and reality. The encounters, whether in the quiet of a Texas bedroom or the mystery of wooded trails, were individual threads in a larger tapestry that connected the experiences of those who encountered the cycloptic beings to the collective human journey toward understanding. In the final chapter of the tale, the cycloptic enigma revealed itself to be more than a series of mysterious encounters. It was a mirror reflecting the human condition, a condition marked by the ceaseless quest for knowledge in the face of the unknowable. The stories of those who came face to face with the cycloptic beings were not just tales of fear and wonder. They were part of the ongoing narrative of humanity's attempt to make sense of a universe that remained, in many ways, a profound and unfathomable mystery.